From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a new political ad campaign was launched in 17 battleground states. The ads were produced by the Media Fund, a Democratic group unaffiliated with the Democratic National Committee. Since the Media Fund is supported by soft money, big donations from unions, corporations, and millionaires, and so on, under the new campaign finance reform law, its commercials are supposed to confine themselves to issues. They're not supposed to call for the election or defeat of a candidate for national office. What do you think?
President Bush, remember the American dream? It's about hope, not fear. It's about more jobs at home, not tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas. It's about giving our children their chance, not our debt. It's about providing health care for people, not just profits. It's about fighting for the middle class, not special interests. George Bush's priorities are eroding the American dream. It's time to take our country back from corporate greed and make America work for every American.
Democratic groups like the Media Fund have been established as 527s. That's shorthand for the provision of the tax law that governs them. Now, they say they're operating entirely within the law. The Bush-Cheney campaign disagrees, and the groups are facing legal scrutiny by the Federal Election Commission. We're joined now by media consultant Carl Strubel. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, Carl, you've been a media consultant on several high-profile Democratic campaigns. What do you think of the Media Fund ad?
I think it raises appropriate questions about whether the priorities of this country are really the ones that are being pursued by the president.
I guess it's not actually telling people to vote against him. However, it does seem like this is a direct violation of the campaign finance law. My understanding is that when you use soft money, you have to confine yourself to issues.
Well, I think they are raising issues. When you look at it, it really is asking a question, are you on my side as an average working American, somebody that works for a paycheck, or are you on the side of somebody in the boardroom? And I think this raises that question in people's minds. And, you know, I'm pretty certain that this is going to be found to be legitimate and legal.
But don't you think the Media Fund ad is, as the Bush-Cheney campaign might suggest, a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing? I mean, this is an ad against Bush and for Kerry.
There are, you know, right-wing groups right now that are doing the same thing, you know, for the Bush campaign. You know, for them to say that somehow we don't do it and they do is really disingenuous.
And in fact, we have an ad ready to play for you from a conservative group called Citizen United, which doesn't call itself a 527 group, but a 501 nonprofit, also covered under the laws in ways that perhaps you can explain for me. And let's play that.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Hairstyle by Christoph's, $75. Designer shirts, $250. 42-foot luxury yacht, $1 million. Four lavish mansions and beachfront estate, over $30 million. Another rich liberal elitist from Massachusetts who claims he's a man of the people. Priceless.
Taking off your Democratic hat for a moment, pretty funny ad, right?
Well, it's, you know, it's pretty funny ad, particularly coming from, you know, the vice president from Halliburton and the president of, you know, the big oil companies of America. I mean, you know, give me a break.
But it's not coming from them.
Well, come on.
If the Media Fund isn't a direct extension of the Democratic National Committee, then how can you say that Citizen United is a direct extension of the Republican National Committee?
Let me just say, I didn't say that either one of them are direct extensions. What I am saying is the way the law is set up now, you have all kinds of groups that will promote the election of Bush and will promote the election of whatever Democrat would have been nominated, because that's what's in their best interest. They've taken the law and they've used it to the best that they can. I believe that they're perfectly legal. But for both sides to somehow suggest that either one of them is illegal or that either one of them isn't somehow or another, you know, promoting issues that might be beneficial to somebody, I think is disingenuous. I mean, of course they are.
Do you know the difference between a 501, which Citizen United calls itself, and the 527, which the Media Fund calls itself?
No, and I can tell you there are a bunch of lawyers in this town who are still trying to figure out the differences. What we've got is a new law that is in the process of being interpreted.
It sounds to me as if the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law, which was supposed to prevent corporate money from hijacking the political ad landscape, just doesn't work because these are political ads. They're for candidates. They're not really explicitly for any specific issue, which is what I think McCain-Feingold had in mind. So I guess, would you agree that McCain-Feingold ultimately will have no impact?
It's very hard to legislate the First Amendment. You know, we're talking about free speech here and about the ability to talk about issues in ways that may be helpful to one side or the other. Now, they can pass all the laws they want unless they outlaw, you know, money in campaigns and make everybody have exactly the same amount. Both sides are going to figure out ways to level the field out.
And that's what we're seeing right now.
That's exactly what you're seeing.
I'm still wondering how, for the purposes of the law, one distinguishes between an issue ad and a pro or anti-candidate ad.
As long as you don't say vote for or vote against somebody, you can say just about anything, as I understand that law.
Carl Struble, thank you very much.
Sure.
Carl Struble is a founder of Struble Eichenbaum Communications.
So you're watching Comedy Central on the tube, and suddenly a crawl runs along the bottom of the screen. It's from Viacom, owner of the cable channel, and other favorites such as MTV and Nickelodeon. It tells you that EchoStar, your satellite TV provider, is going to take away your Comedy Central. And suddenly the crawl begins to disappear because someone out there is covering it over with black. That would be EchoStar, which went on to actually drop Viacom channels from their Dish network, but by the end of the week caved into Viacom's demand and put them back on the air. Joining us now with the blow-by-blow recap is Joe Flint, media reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Joe, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Describe exactly what happened between EchoStar and Viacom.
Well, basically, it was a contract negotiation that blew up. Viacom was negotiating a new deal for EchoStar to carry its CBS television stations, as well as some of its cable networks like Comedy Central, BET, Nickelodeon, MTV. And they wanted to have EchoStar carry some of their new channels like Nicktoons, which is a new kids cartoon channel they're launching, in return for carrying the CBS stations. And EchoStar felt that they were being extorted. And it's just one of these battles where no one blinked until ultimately the channels went off the air.
This is not the first time we've seen these kinds of squabbles break out into the public view.
Right. Time Warner and Disney, which is ABC's parent, had a very similar battle about 4 years ago, and that turned into a much bigger outcry than what we saw with EchoStar, because there was a lot more consumers impacted by the Time Warner situation.
And then Fox was in a dispute with Cox Cable at one point, no?
Yes, viewers went for about a week without Fox broadcasting, and in some cases actually, you know, missed out on some football and other events.
This time around, as with the others, there was this very public spectacle of the guerrilla war in which both Viacom and EchoStar struggled to get its side of the story across to viewers, some of whom I'm sure were quite perplexed. But tell me about some of the tactics employed by the two giants.
EchoStar hosted the home phone number of Viacom president Mel Karmazin on its website, telling their subscribers, you know, you might lose these channels, call Mel and complain. Viacom was running a scroll across its channels, telling subscribers that this is not our doing, call EchoStar and let them know you don't want to lose your favorite channels. And then once the channels were gone, I think Viacom just really seemed to be more prepared for this. They had ads ready to go, like the ones that were in newspapers using their characters, such as SpongeBob, to spread the word that these channels were off and that, you know, viewers should start subscribing to DirecTV or to their local cable system. And EchoStar, as far as I can tell, really didn't have any sort of rebuttal. They should have been out months in advance making their case to their subscribers about why they thought Viacom was in the wrong here.
Do you have any sense that consumers were able to figure out who was who in all of this? I mean, at some point, don't consumers just sit there and say, I'm not getting my shows on the TV, but with no notion whatsoever of the various parties to the dispute?
That's correct, and that was why EchoStar, I think, played a bad hand. The consumer, they turn on their television and their channel's not there. They don't blame the person who owns the channel. They blame the cable company or the satellite company. You know, it's just the way of the world.
And did, in the end, EchoStar agree to take the package of programs that originally they didn't want any part of?
They agreed to take the package and then some. Besides carrying Nicktoons, they extended other deals that hadn't expired yet for some Viacom channels, such as TV Land and Spike TV. And the two sides also agreed to settle all their litigation, because EchoStar's big hope was that no matter what happened here, they were going to take this issue of bundling to the courts and win there. So, you know, I'd say just from my vantage point, EchoStar was humbled here.
Can we conclude from this contretemps that, at least in the early part of the new millennium, that content is still king?
In this case, I think content is still king. I mean, this is why Comcast wants to buy Disney. You know, they don't want to buy Disney to own theme parks. They want to buy Disney to own ESPN, to own the Family Channel, to own the Disney Channel. You know, Comcast has all the distribution in the world. They're the biggest cable operator in the country, but they need programming. So, yeah, I think content is still king.
So what does that presage for a world of increasingly consolidated and increasingly vertically integrated big media?
I think as both the distribution and content sides get even more consolidated, there's more of a likelihood for these companies to dig in and really stick to their guns on these battles, almost forgetting that there's a consumer out there that should be their first priority to serve.
And is there anything we can do about it? Or we just got to sit here and take it?
Well, you know, yeah, there's not much really the consumer can do. I mean, in this case, sure, you could have dropped EchoStar right off the bat and signed up for DirecTV. But maybe 3 years from now, DirecTV will be battling with ESPN over something, and then you might be in the same situation. No, you know, short of turning off the set and picking up a book, there's not a lot you can do.
Okay, Joe. Well, listen, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Joe Flint reports on the media for the Wall Street Journal.
Coming up, a media circus in Redwood City and the many faces of public broadcasting around the world.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Tensions are once again flaring on the ultra-polarized streets of Venezuela. Opponents of President Hugo Chavez have gathered millions of signatures in support of a referendum on the ouster of Chavez. But the government proceeded to disqualify hundreds of thousands of those signatures for technical reasons, and the opposition is crying foul. If you tune into any of Venezuela's privately owned TV channels, you'll hear news anchors railing against a dictatorial regime that has stolen an election before a vote was ever cast. State TV, unsurprisingly, offers a different perspective. But lately, a third option has been emerging in the working-class neighborhoods of Caracas and elsewhere in the countryside.
Campaña para enviar emisoras de radio a comunidades populares en Venezuela.
A campaign to set up radio stations in Venezuelan communities. The media is under the control of the bosses and the coup organizers in their campaign of terror and lies. They're disseminating hate and calling for sedition and the reactionary overthrow of President Chavez.
New York Times reporter Juan Ferrero wrote this week about the legions of tiny community radio stations that are sympathetic to Chavez and that will this year be rewarded for their efforts with $2.6 million in government money. Ferrero joins us on the line now from Caracas. Juan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How much reach does the community radio have?
It's unclear. It's nothing near the reach of the private television stations. These are not very powerful transmitters that they have, but apparently so many of them are popping up that they're starting to cover wide areas. If there is a referendum, I think that the stations will play an even bigger role some months down the road, and by that time, more of these community stations will be up and running, and my guess is that they'll be more and more political as time goes on.
Are they themselves unified in support of Chavez, or is it truly independent radio?
I wouldn't say that they're all truly unified in support of Chavez. I think that many, if not most of them, perhaps maybe more importantly, are in opposition to the opposition.
For your story, you visited a few of the low-power stations. Who's running them? What kind of people did you meet there?
You meet many different kinds of people. Some of them are not political people at all. They're just teenagers, housewives, people like that who have been given an avenue to express themselves. There's kids who are just playing CDs. Others have come up with a variety of different programs where they might speak about very mundane things like how to make a budget, how to shop for certain things without spending too much money. And then you do find a number of political people, people who have ties to the Chavez political party or people who are just active in various Chavez organizations.
My recollection of some of these neighborhoods is one of just grinding poverty, of dwellings that are little more than shacks with corrugated tin roofs. I'm having trouble squaring my recollections with the idea of running a radio station within. Where does the money come from?
Well, some of the money does come from the government. These are very simple, even primitive transmitters that are set up in people's homes or in the lobby of a housing complex. So it doesn't take a lot of money to get one of these things started up. And in fact, probably one of the biggest obstacles was just getting a license. In the past, these places were shut down by the government, but under the Chavez government, they want these places to really flourish. And one of the things that they've done is they have enacted a law that facilitates licenses to these places quite easily. And now Chavez has announced that there will be new funding this year for a number of these radio stations.
Let's talk for a moment about the unsuccessful coup in April of 2002, when Chavez was spirited out of his palace in the middle of the night, only to return in triumph, I guess, a few days later. One of the first things the coup leaders did when they set their plan into action was to take control of the state-run television station. How did the Chavistas get the message about what was going on and to mount the pro-Chavez demonstrations that drew so many thousands of people into the streets?
The community radio stations had a big role. While the private media blacked out what was going on after the coup, they were broadcasting, you know, soap operas and stuff like that. The neighborhood radio stations were the ones that were reporting what was happening. So many people in the barrios knew that Chavez had been spirited away, and they also knew that there was an effort to reinstall him. And, of course, that led thousands of people to come in from the hills and take part in a very important uprising that in turn led to Chavez being reinstated.
One of the criticisms from the commercial and political establishment in Venezuela to Chavez is that he's growing increasingly authoritarian. And yet, unlike other authoritarian regimes, this one doesn't seem to be trying to pour water on inflammatory media coverage. They seem to be fighting fire with fire.
One of the reasons why the government hates the private media, particularly the television stations, is because they're not really just supportive of the opposition here. They are part of the opposition. They're a radical element within the opposition. I mean, they go to the meetings. They have decision-making powers and so forth. And during the coup, they had a big role in basically his ouster. Chavez certainly has in the past threatened that he would shut down stations and jail media executives, but that's rhetoric. I think that Chavez may simply be trying to ignore the opposition. He's got a lot of other people who support him here, and he's decided to just try to focus on winning hearts and minds in that sector of the population.
All right. Well, Juan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Juan Ferrero covers Venezuela for the New York Times.
While the Venezuelan government furnishes a lifeline for sympathetic broadcasters in the barrios, recent events in the European mediascape have officials there re-examining their own commitment to public broadcasting. State-funded media have deep roots on the continent, but a recent spate of journalistic errors, like the scandal surrounding the BBC's coverage of pre-war intelligence, has public broadcasters under mounting pressure from commercial competitors and hostile politicians. We've seen similar debates in Congress here. Just last month, public broadcasters were called back up to Capitol Hill to make a case for continued subsidies. Those subsidies amount to less than 20% of their budgets. But as Eric Fanner recently wrote in the International Herald Tribune, there's a good deal more at stake in Europe.
In most countries, a much larger percentage than 20% comes from public sources. It may be through taxes and direct grants from the government. More likely, the way it is in Britain or in France, is through license fees, where people are billed for the use of a television in their home, and they have to pay a certain amount of money every year, which can be quite substantial just to have the privilege of a television in their home.
So what's happening over there? I mean, listeners to our show probably know more than they would like to about the BBC's problems with the Blair government. And of course, now the BBC is undergoing a previously scheduled review that could change the entire face of all the BBC properties. Is that happening in France and in Germany and in Italy?
It's probably not as formalized, but there are calls from commercial competitors in France, in Germany, in Italy, for a change in the system, people saying this is not a level playing field. And there are, of course, politicians who are lining up on one side or the other. In France, what we saw over the last couple of weeks was a drama where the state-funded or publicly funded broadcaster, France 2, one of the television channels, incorrectly reported about the resignation of a former prime minister from several political posts he still holds. And what that did is it cast a harsh light on that broadcaster's own operations and resulted in the resignation of its news director and the suspension of a popular news anchor. There's a big competition between France 2 and its commercial competitor, TF1, which is the largest broadcaster in France. So there's speculation that the pressure to get on the air fastest with the news might have played a role. And of course, this is the kind of commercial pressure that publicly funded broadcasters didn't necessarily have in years past, when they could rely on comfortably going forward with a big chunk of the market.
Now, if it was mostly commercial pressures, perhaps in France, then you'd have to say that it was mostly political pressure that public broadcasting is under in Italy.
That's right. The government of Prime Minister Berlusconi has three of the positions on the board of RAI, the public broadcasting operation there. And there have been a number of cases where there's at least the perception of political influence being used to influence news coverage.
A perception?
maybe that's a bit of a polite way to put it.
Not to put too fine a point on it, Berlusconi has either bought out or pressured through his political connections virtually every news outlet that he doesn't own.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's not necessarily dealing specifically with the public broadcaster, but it obviously demonstrates his intent to influence what's being said in the media in general.
What about Germany? That's pretty much an argument about money, right?
Yeah, there are, from time to time, are complaints there about political interference or too much oversight by politicians, but there haven't been any sort of high-profile incidents. So instead, what you have there is a marketplace battle going on. You have an American investor, Haim Saban, who recently bought one of the largest commercial broadcasters in Germany and has made some calls for the public broadcaster there to wean its way off of public funds because he says this is an unfair playing field. What he really objects to actually is the fact that the public broadcaster is getting public money at the same time that in Germany it is also allowed to sell some advertising.
They get all these revenue streams.
Yeah, in fairness, it's not a huge amount of the revenue stream that comes from commercial sources.
Let me ask you a question that is always asked here. Is public broadcasting outmoded? Has it outlived its usefulness in Europe?
I mean, I think that depends on whom you ask. I mean, for a lot of viewers, 40% of the British audience watches various BBC programming. It produces a lot of the best programming in Britain.
How about France, Italy, and Germany?
In France, France 2, they are actually trailing in the market. They're the second broadcaster there. and they have a somewhat smaller percentage. In Germany, it's also, I believe, a bit over 40%.
The percentages that you talk about for all of those countries, it just far surpasses what American public television has. So that has to suggest that the public still cares about it deeply.
Sure. I think the best poll is to look at what people actually do.
So they're voting with their remotes.
I guess they're voting with their remotes. That's right.
Eric Fanner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Fanner is a reporter for the International Herald Tribune, and he spoke to us from London.
The disappearance of Lacey Peterson on Christmas Eve 2002 in Modesto, California, deluged the local media. Soon after, the tale of the much-loved woman in her eighth month of pregnancy went national. When it emerged that her husband Scott had been carrying on with another woman, he became the chief suspect. By the time he was charged, the judge agreed with his defense attorney that the jury pool in Modesto was tainted, so he moved the trial to Redwood City. But of course, when Peterson's trial moved, the media circus moved with it. Reporter Kathy McAnally has the story.
The whole country thinks that I murdered my wife and my son.
See the untold story of
former fertilizer salesman Scott Peterson has been on the cover of People magazine and the focus of exclusives in the National Enquirer. The USA Network made a TV movie about him. The Perfect Husband aired just 3 weeks before real-life jury selection began.
Redwood City, Rusty Dornan covering the Scott Peterson trial. Rusty?
Well, Kara, it looks like we do have a judge in this case. It was decided
this month, but that will not stop the sordid details of the case from becoming public.
So far, about 500 Peterson trial press credentials have been issued. Bronwyn Hogan is the public information officer for the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department.
A lot of local media, obviously. There's some European press agencies that are represented. We have one represented from GQ magazine who has to be credentialed.
Hogan notes that most stories of husbands charged with killing their wives and children don't translate into banner headlines and huge TV ratings.
There is another inmate in the San Mateo County Jail who's facing three counts of homicide for the death of his pregnant wife, their unborn child, and his four-year-old daughter. It's always difficult to say why one case appeals to the public or to the media more than the other.
But John McManus, who runs a project called Grade the News at Stanford University, thinks he knows why.
I think the Peterson tragedy is a perfect case of what I would call market-driven journalism. It's a story that the marketers who now run many newsrooms search for. This case had all the elements that promised a tragedy they could really cash in on. And those elements are a handsome suburban couple, adultery. You had a pregnant woman missing on Christmas Eve. You had enormous sentimentality.
McManus says he abhors the media frenzy surrounding the Peterson story and the willingness to exploit it.
This is a tragedy. This is a family that's exploded. And just to cynically market that to fill a hotel, to fill a bar, is really distressing to me as somebody who cares about news.
Before the trial moved, several cities marketed themselves as the perfect place to hold it. Once Redwood City got the nod, officials and news organizations haggled like fishwives over the price of space in the media village. There's the constant hum of generators on the street bordering the courthouse. It's been closed to regular traffic for weeks now to make way for huge TV satellite trucks. Since seating in the courthouse is limited, the vast majority of reporters must pace outside, waiting for someone connected to the case to show up with a soundbite. On this day, Scott Peterson's attorney Mark Garagus is expected as technicians discuss where to set up microphones.
Well, just you see, the problem is there's going to be a couple of reporters that decide they want to talk to him over there, then everybody's going to run.
And they'll all be in front of him.
Can we just make a deal and we'll just all do it over here?
Defender Garagus is a no-show, but reporters spot prosecutor James Brazelton crossing the courthouse plaza.
What do you think of those billboards along the freeway?
I haven't seen that.
Pictures of Scott Peterson in his jail jumpsuit and talking about whether he has killed or innocent, asking people to vote on it. It's really raising the profile.
I think it's totally inappropriate.
Are you worried about the USA Network?
Billboards showing Peterson in his orange prison jumpsuit were the brainchild of a local radio station. Man or monster, they screamed.
There's a lot of interest in this, and you wonder, is it the media creating it, or is it the viewers out there who really seem to just be insatiable in terms of their desire to have coverage on this case?
That's Kimberly Guilfoyle Newsom, an on-camera legal analyst for Court TV, CNN, and ABC News. She predicts that Peterson's own words in old TV interviews, earnestly proclaiming his loyalty to Lacey, will be played back in court.
You have the media playing such a large role because you've got this TV movie, you have all the extended coverage of it, and you have Scott Peterson talking extensively to the press, and you can bet that that's going to be used in the court against him.
Guilfoyle Newsom used to be a prosecutor. Her work on the infamous San Francisco dog mauling case got her lots of TV FaceTime and a new career as a broadcaster.
I mean, we've seen back-to-back, day-in and day-out coverage of this Peterson case, and it's really been quite remarkable, and you don't see any let-up. I mean, I've been on Larry King about it so many times, all of the different networks, and the viewership is just enormous. The ratings are huge for these types of cases, and I think really why it is, it's like a reality television. This is like murder mysteries, but they're real.
And what's real for Scott Peterson is that he's on trial for his life. For On the Media, I'm Kathy McAnally.
Coming up, Spin Sisters, Sisters with Attitude, and 12 foolproof ways to tighten your abs.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This just in from the world of reality TV. Complex human beings are being edited into two-dimensional stereotypes that are none too positive. This season brought us several versions of one popular stock character, the Sista with Attitude. She was on The Apprentice and America's Next Top Model and Survivor All-Stars. Teresa Wiltz chronicled this stereotype for The Washington Post in a story called The Evil Sista of Reality Television. She says that producers, editors, and the subjects themselves are complicit in bolstering stereotypes as a way to furnish the shows with recognizable characters. The Sista with Attitude character is an ornery black woman, and according to Wiltz, that's about all we get to see.
She's going to be very confrontational. She's probably going to be wagging her finger in their face, like Alicia from Survivor All-Stars, who talked about basically her shtick, which is the finger, capital T, capital F.
There is a talent to the finger. You can't do it without the head. You can't just do the head without the finger. It's got to be both. You got to be really angry, and you have to be in the moment. You know what I mean? So you have to be a little ghetto. You have to have a little rhythm, you know, and you have to be mad. You have to let it out from every part, you know? What happens to people that get in my way? You haven't seen me do the finger? That's what's going to happen.
That's Alicia. How about the woman on America's Next Top Model?
Camille is the woman who thinks that she's beautiful and she's got a body and she thinks that's enough. So she, again, also has alienated all the cast members. And there was a scene where they were all acting in an acting class and they were all supposed to recount some painful episode. And so everyone does this and just starts boohooing. And Camille is like, no. I'm not going to dig into my past and start crying in front of you all, which I don't blame her, frankly. But then that further alienated her from the rest of the cast who were fulfilling yet another stereotype, which is the whiny crying girl.
Now, for the breakout bitch of the year, that would have to be Omarosa from The Apprentice. Tell me about her.
Omarosa is a former Clinton political appointee, but exactly what she was appointed to do, we're not sure. Tall, elegant, icy, and just a hag. I mean, she would say things like, please take responsibility for your actions, which no one wants to hear. But at any rate, she's fired. She's out of there. And she says she's been the victim of a smear and it's all bad editing.
Omarosa, this competition isn't about how much you know. It's about leadership and getting along with your team. It's not about distracting your teammates from the task at hand. Omarosa, go out and sell paintings or whatever the hell you're doing. I don't like excuses. In this case, Omarosa has to go. You're fired.
And I'm like, ouch. Now, there are other stereotypes in reality TV. You mentioned in your piece the small-town knave trying to hold on to his values and so forth. The bumbling bigot who doesn't even realize that he's an Archie Bunker character in the making. And then the troubled soul you describe who's just one step away from rehab. But the sister with attitude comes lugging a whole lot of racial baggage
right.
as well. Does it make this a little more dangerous and more concerning than the run-of-the-mill caricature that we see on reality TV?
Oh, I think so. Someone I had spoken with who writes for Reality Blurred says that basically with these shows, these archetypes are cast. There's very little time to convey character or anything like that. It's very plot-driven. So they're these images that people think they recognize. So they can go, oh, yeah, I know her. I think it is dangerous because it does reinforce stereotypes that people have. Looking at message boards about Omarosa, she is so hated. And I read a lot of them. They all mentioned that black girl. She couldn't just be, you know, that pain in the ass political appointee. It was always in reference to her race. And so she becomes a stand-in for every other black woman out there, which I think is unfair. And there are other black women that don't fit that stereotype that are in reality TV, but it's usually the woman who's perceived to be the troublemaker that's going to get the airtime.
Please tell me that there's something uplifting in all of this, something that you can take out of this that's not just another depressing observation about the media culture. Is there no good news to the Sassy Sister story?
Well, I think the fact that you've got someone like Omarosa, who is so obviously talented, accomplished, attractive, without fitting into stereotypical norms of, you know, what's beautiful in white America, you know, a strong, tall, dark-skinned sister that Donald Trump acknowledges is just gorgeous and smart, and she's a PhD candidate. She's obviously comes equipped with a lot of savvy. And so I think in that's great news.
The only problem is she's a total pain in the ass.
Right. You know, I think what's sad is that she's not allowed to just be a pain in the ass. There's always going to be a racial component to it. And so for me, I wish there would be a day, being totally naive and optimistic, when you can just be a total bitch and it doesn't matter what color you are.
Teresa Wiltz is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She wrote the piece titled The Evil Sister of Reality Television.
Thanks for having me.
Myrna Blythe, for two decades editor-in-chief of Ladies' Home Journal and founding editor of More, has written a tell-all that has incensed many of her former colleagues in the magazine world. She calls these high-powered, pampered, liberal editors, anchorwomen, and publicists spin sisters, and she says they use glossy magazines or their TV equivalents to foist their petty obsessions and lefty politics on an audience that does not share their values. The spin sisters, says Blythe, set up false expectations for beauty and for happiness, celebrate selfishness, and suggest the world is a dangerous place riddled with killer mattresses, cell phones, and hair dyes, and worst of all, crippling stress. Blythe says the spin sisters rake in the dough by selling images of women as victims, but it's the spin sisters themselves who are doing the victimizing. Myrna, do I have this right?
Well, to a large degree, you do. I do think media for women tell women constantly that they are frazzled and frumpy and have so many things to be fearful about, which, of course, is not an accurate picture of women's lives today.
Let's go through some of the principal images or ideas that you think only do us harm. You talk about the magazine cover where they took a year-old picture of Julia Roberts' head and put it on a four-year-old picture of her body.
Absolutely. And then they said the real Julia Roberts. habits. Well, of course. I mean, those are the techniques that people use.
And you did that yourself, right, at Ladies'
Home
Journal?
To some degree. I mean, once I admit it, I confess, we put Cher, who was wearing something absolutely impossible, and sort of changed her clothes, and she got very upset. But we did say we did less to Cher than Cher has done to herself. But she had a reason to complain. But, you know, that's just part of it. What concerns me even more are telling women that everyone is stressed. We have defined stress so far downward, it has become the cellulite of today. Everybody's got it. And, you know, women feel that if they have to come home and decide between Domino's or Hamburger Helper, that's stress. Well, that's not stress. And I really wrote the book so that women would realize that they are getting only one point of view about a whole variety of things. You know, magazines will say to women, as they did in the last presidential election, a vote for Gore is a vote for you, even though half their readers in their own polls said they were voting for George W. Bush. Well, is that fair to only give one point of view?
Now, you write, and I quote, "I am partly to blame for creating the negative images of victimization and unhappiness that bombard women today." It made you successful. If it so disgusted you, why didn't you stop when it could have done some good?
You know, I think I did two things that I think are very important. In the mid-90s, something called the Media Research Center, which I really didn't know what it was, a conservative media watchdog group, did say that the Ladies' Home Journal, when it came to politics and social issues, was by far the most unbiased magazine. And I was always very concerned of showing both sides about social issues. And the other thing I did in the late 90s, when I really was so tired of sending messages like stress, 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 I started More Magazine, which is a magazine for women in their 40s and 50s. And it is a rare magazine with an optimistic basis.
I wonder, women born after 1970, so-called third-wave feminists, don't appear to require that the curtain be pulled back on the women's magazine business. They already seem to know. They know about the consumer values, the manipulation, the unrealistic expectations, the airbrushing. They know what they're buying: empty calories, a little dessert after an actual meal.
But I do think it has influence. I do think Cosmopolitan, which is read by young women, and their belief that all women are sexually free does influence teenagers, which may not be accurate. What's interesting to me about feminism is how it has morphed into narcissism. In other words, nowadays, you are supposed to do it for yourself because you deserve it, basically shopping and pampering, you know, and you're supposed to have time for yourself. As I think I say in the book, that taking the kids to the beach, that's work. Having a pedicure, that's for you. Not having time for a pedicure, that's stress. Certainly, that's not what feminism was about, but that's what it's morphed to in women's magazines.
I have to admit that this book, which was really fun, was also one of the cattier books that I've ever read. For instance, and I'll give you a couple of examples, you sniff at the Spin Sisters' pastel-colored suits, and you called CNN's Margaret Carlson a Harry Potter lookalike.
Oh, you know, but let me be honest. Women like Katie Couric and Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer market themselves to women like just one of the girls. That's part of this unique power they have. You know, they can dish diets and grill the president. They can gush over celebrities and report from Iraq. It's a unique position that men in media do not have. They tend to market themselves just like you. Well, let's be honest. Someone who earns $13 to $16 million a year is not just like most women in America. It's a marketing technique, and yet a very influential one. And that's what I was pointing out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Myrna Blythe is author of Spin Sisters, How the Women of Media Sell Unhappiness and Liberalism to the Women of America.
Generally speaking, the editors at, say, Newsweek don't have a problem coming up with story ideas. They look back a week and rehash the news. If that doesn't suggest a cover story, they can always explain all-world religion or terrorism or Britney Spears. But some editors haven't the luxury afforded by random events. Golfing, hunting, karate, beauty, fitness. Specialty publications, not news-driven, have to generate stories relying solely on their own editorial imaginations, while basically covering the same material again and again and again.
I was thinking, obviously, our average reader doesn't have a trainer all the time.
Right.
But if we could do some kind of comparison where we have three women or four women start a six-week regimen where everyone... Are we doing that?
We're trying to do it. It's sort of...
This is the story meeting at Fitness, the women's magazine of body, mind, and spirit. And things are a little tense. Every story suggested seems so been done already.
There's something there, but I don't think
we
nailed it.
What if you throw diet into the mix and say, you know, maybe they all want to lose...
Like different
20
tactics.
Pounds or something,
right.
And one
totally
person tries
tactics.
Diet alone, one person tries exercise alone, and then another person has both.
But we tell people all the time that you need both.
One by one, the staffers pitch ideas, and one by one, gently, Editor-in-Chief Emily Listfield shoots them down. But in time, the magazine will be filled because, Listfield explains, it's just a question of tuning into the readers.
It's just listening to women talk. And when you listen to women talk, you get a million ideas. There's something new every day that they're curious about.
The problem is that curiosity is limited to very few spheres of human existence. For instance, in the June issue, the cover boasted a 30-minute thigh sculpting workout, whereas in May, it was a better butt in 10 minutes, and in July, it was the breakthrough workout to burn fat all day long. Fitness, of course, is for women. A men's health magazine has concerns far different from feminine body obsession. Steve Perrine is the editorial creative director of Men's Health.
Women tend to be self-conscious about their thighs and their butts, and men tend to be self-conscious about their stomachs.
So hence, in July, the fastest ab plan ever. In June, you had a story, 10 greatest ab exercises ever. May, all-star abs. October, find your abs. September, machine-built abs. A lot of ab stories.
Well, some of the stories are part of plans that we put together, which guys can follow month to month. Others are very particular, interesting takes. For example, the All-Star Abs, what we did is we picked a bunch of athletes and celebrities who are in particularly great shape, and we had them give us their workouts.
Celebrity abs. Nice touch. Both editors insist their magazines offer fresh takes on the kinds of issues most important to their readers. In fact, according to John Fine, my advertising age colleague on the magazine beat, readers may want nothing more from their glossies than a game effort to wrap familiar material in new packages, because whether the category is beauty or fitness or golf, these magazines tend to be feeding fantasies in the first place.
There's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to, you know, golf a 72. I mean, there's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to drop 20 pounds and, you know, put on 15 pounds of lean body weight. But, I mean, if you're looking at it really obsessively, there's an infinite amount of variation. There's an infinite amount of ways you can talk about it. It becomes, I don't know, like a song that you listen to over and over again.
Or maybe, in its endless superficial variation on theme, like pornography. Or maybe another vice altogether.
To me, instruction editorial is the heroine of golf magazines. It may make you feel good for a moment, but it really kills creativity in the publication, I think.
John Atwood is editor-in-chief of Travel and Leisure Golf, a magazine that prides itself on transcending the five tips for mastering the sand wedge sort of material that fills its competition month after month. We visited his editorial meeting, too, and found a magazine with content bounded only by the limitations of its travel budget.
Oh, Ireland. On one of our trips last year, we used the services of a helicopter company, and that seems to be becoming the preferred mode of transportation around Ireland. So, you know, given who our audience is, I think we need to do something on that topic.
The Irish helicopter tour was such a fetching subject, in fact, that Travel and Leisure Golf had done it already in the current issue. No problem for coming issues, though. There are many other countries and several other modes of transportation. Editors such as Atwood have one sort of challenge, interesting essentially the same audience month after month. Diane Forden of Bridal Guide magazine has the opposite problem, interesting an ever-changing pool of readers without boring herself right out of her skull. Her readership turns over every 6 to 14 months.
So that's the creative challenge, especially when you work for a bridal magazine, is how do we keep this material fresh? How do we keep it relevant? How do we, you know, get the reader excited, keep ourselves excited?
But every month she has to do a wedding gown story, and every month she has to do a wedding planning story, and every month she has to do a cake story.
We don't want to photograph the same type of cake story. I think once we did a cake for all seasons, so it was different wedding cakes for your seasons. We didn't want to repeat that, but we still wanted to present an idea of showing wonderful wedding cakes, but what was our theme? What was our idea? You know, we repeat ourselves, yes, but we always give it a new twist, a new angle.
It's all about angles. The editorial process at these magazines is about 10% journalism and 90% geometry.
Everybody's always doing look great naked. I really like the idea of feel great naked. 50 Reasons to Love Your Body.
50 Reasons to Love Your Body. Splendid idea. Next month, 51 Reasons to Love Your Body. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Derek John and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.